This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with New York attorney Richard Roth, who filed a lawsuit against Mike Pompeo and the CIA for spying on Julian Assange and his visitors in the Ecuadorian embassy.
Some of those visitors were his attorneys. They got no right to do this. What they're trying to do is shut down investigative journalism. This is the most important case for journalists and the American public that's going on today.
We will also rebroadcast an interview that Heidi Boghossian and Michael Smith did with Senator Bob Graham, who discussed the involvement and support of the Saudi government to the 9/11 hijackers.
A courageous man, but he got that information out. Listen to this interview.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. Journalist Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks, is in a London prison fighting extradition to the United States. Donald Trump's CIA director Mike Pompeo was angered by the 2017 WikiLeaks revelation of the CIA's Vault 7 program, whereby the CIA was able to tap into people's cell phones and smart TVs, turning them into listening devices. The Trump administration filed an indictment against Assange, which takes aim at him and WikiLeaks for their 2010 exposure of U.S. war crimes in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay. The Biden administration is pursuing Assange's extradition and prosecution. If he is extradited, tried, and convicted, Assange could receive 175 years in prison. When Assange was living in the Ecuadorian embassy in London under a grant of asylum, the CIA hired UC Global, a private security company, to spy on Assange and his visitors and turn over images from the cell phones and laptops of lawyers, journalists, and doctors to the CIA. On August 15th, some of the lawyers and journalists who visited Assange sued the CIA and Pompeo in U.S. District Court for violation of their Fourth Amendment rights. They are requesting money damages, an injunction to prevent the CIA from revealing their private communications, and the purging of CIA files of this information. The lawsuit against Pompeo and the CIA was filed by the Roth Law Firm in New York City. The lead lawyer who represents the plaintiffs is Richard Roth. Highly regarded for his successful and creative representation, Roth's clients include celebrities, nationally recognized artists, singers, actors, songwriters, and Hall of Fame and All-Star athletes, directors, producers, and professional sports organizations. Roth worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office and interned for a judge on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. The recipient of numerous awards, Roth is a frequent media commentator. We are fortunate to have Richard Roth with us on Law and Disorder to discuss the lawsuit against Pompeo and the CIA. Richard Roth, welcome to Law and Disorder. Richard Roth, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hey, thank you for having me.
What is UC Global, and how did you find out that it had been spying on Julian Assange and his visitors while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy in London?
So UC Global is just a company that does security detail. They don't really, they in and of themselves, there's nothing spectacular or different about them. They are hired, as you would hire a security guard or even a bouncer for a bar, to make sure that everything is copacetic. And knowing that Mr. Assange was in the Ecuadorian embassy, they wanted to make sure that there was a company there that was just, that there'd be no inappropriate conduct by anyone. So UC that's the answer who UC Global is. And what we learned was through various different sources, including a Spanish court, which has a criminal proceeding pending, we learned that in or about 2017, UC Global had attended what was called the SHOT, S-H-O-T convention, January 2017. And it stands for Shooting, Hunting, and Outdoor Show. Defendant David Morales, who we've also sued, was at the show, and he was one of the presenters at the show for private security services. And he met up with Sheldon Adelson, who is a very good friend. Well, was very close to the prior administration, Donald Trump, Mike Pompeo. And he introduced Mr. Pompeo to the security company for the purposes of essentially doing more at the Ecuadorian embassy than just maintaining security, to actually spy on all the people that went to the Ecuadorian embassy and Mr. Assange. And they did it, and essentially they did two things. First, they were directed to image anything and everything that came, anyone's personal property that came to the embassy. When they went to the embassy, you had to give the security detail there your phone, your laptop, your iPad, anything that was electric. And they, while the person went to visit Mr. Assange inside, in the doors, they imaged everything. And the second thing they did was that they actually put, unbeknownst to anyone there, they actually put recording devices and cameras in the rooms where Mr. Assange was, which essentially live streamed what he was doing and saying back to Washington. And we're talking about conversations with lawyers, which are attorney-client protected, conversations with doctors, which are patient-doctor protected. And all of this came out in the Spanish proceeding because, quite frankly, the UC Global people who have submitted affidavits in the Spanish proceeding, that's not what they bargained for. These are security guards who learned that they were literally providing information to, as Morales told them, American intelligence, the dark side. And so all this came out in the Spanish proceeding, and it struck us as, quite frankly, we were outraged, because the CIA should not have information of a person that they're actually trying to put in jail, or the person, the government, I should say, is trying to put in jail. So as a result, we commenced this action on behalf of a few people that were there, but people are coming out of the woodwork saying, I was there too, can I join in? There were hundreds of visitors for Mr. Assange over close to 6-year period. So that's essentially how we learned of it and what they were doing. It started with the SHOT convention, and it went to the embassy, and it's been going on. It had been going on during his last, at minimum, 2 years at the embassy.
Richard, why do you think the CIA was so interested in Assange?
This all goes back to when Assange, my belief is that it all goes back to when Assange, or WikiLeaks, reported information it obtained from Manning, and claiming, quite frankly, Pompeo called Assange a non-state hostile organization in his very first speech. So it goes back to when WikiLeaks just published information. And what's important to know is that WikiLeaks and Assange didn't take anything. They were in a very different situation than was Manning. They were provided information. They did nothing different than what the New York Times does. They essentially got information and published it. And from there on, Pompeo in particular really wanted to shut down Mr. Assange, including and in his very first speech, in Mr. Pompeo's very first speech when he was a CIA director, he said, I want to shut down Assange. He called him a narcissist, a fraud, a coward, and he called him, and I quote, a non-state hostile intelligence service, which is crazy. I mean, all he is a publisher. So that's why they were so outraged with Assange, because information was leaked to him, and he did nothing different than the New York Times did with the papers, the Pentagon papers. And you read every day in Fox News does it, CNN does it. And so for some reason they had this axe to grind with Assange when he was just a publisher, nothing more.
For those listeners who've just tuned in, we're speaking with attorney Richard Roth. Richard is representing the plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the CIA. Richard, tell me about your clients, the plaintiffs in this lawsuit.
So my clients consist of, as I mentioned a little while ago, there are several people coming out of the woodwork, but the actual plaintiffs, there are four plaintiffs. Two of them are lawyers, and two of them are journalists. And the two lawyers, one of them is Margaret Ratner Kunstler, who is the wife of Bill Kunstler, who died, I think, in 1995. She's a civil rights attorney in her own right, very renowned. Deborah Urbeck is a media attorney. They went in to meet with Assange about whatever it was they were speaking about, the attorney-client relationship. The other two people are journalists who went in to essentially write stories about Assange. And they, quite frankly, are outraged, the lawyers in particular. Not only is it a violation of the attorney-client privilege to take information, but think about it. If they image Ms. Kunstler's and Ms. Urbeck's computers, then they have presumably other attorney-client information, which they shouldn't have, from clients that were just on the laptop. On top of all that, it's a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. There's a right to privacy, and the CIA has absolutely no right to go in and essentially take information under color of law without any search warrant just because they wanted to. So that's who the plaintiffs are. As I said, other people are coming out of the woodworks. Doctors have come to me. Other journalists have come to me. Other lawyers have come to me. I'm not sure if we're going to amend and add them or not. But there are well over 100 people that went to visit Mr. Assange. So presumably from January 2019 on, all of those people's computers were imaged.
And also their cell phones.
Yeah, their laptops, their cell phones, their iPads, whatever they had was imaged.
Richard, in addition to violation of the Fourth Amendment prohibition against unreasonable search and seizure, what evidentiary privileges did UC Global and the CIA violate?
Well, so the top three, the big three. One is obviously the Fourth Amendment. Two is the by taking information that was in the possession of a lawyer and listening in on conversation between a lawyer and a client, they violated that privilege. The individual, the client, has an expectation that his conversations with a lawyer will remain confidential. So that's the second. And the third, which is as bad, is that Mr. Assange for years was actually had doctors come in. Remember, he was pent up in this Ecuadorian embassy for, I think, 6 years. And so all the conversation he had with the doctors, that was all also taken. And then let's add to that the fact that if the doctors came in with a laptop and they had information on their computer which was of other patients, it's clearly a violation of that. So there are so many violations. It's really shocking that Pompeo thought he could do this and thought he had a right to do it.
So, Attorney Richard Roth, what are you asking the district court to do?
So we're asking for several things. First and foremost, we want all of the information that was taken to be destroyed and or returned, that the CIA purged from its files any information it acquired. And we're asking for to basically enjoin the defendants from utilizing or revealing to any third party the content of the communications, both the communications that were contemporaneous and whatever was on the electronic devices that were imaged. And then we're asking for monetary damages. We believe that it's an outrage that the federal government would essentially take it on its own to spy on these people who had a right to privacy. So that's really those three things: money damages, an injunction to not have them use it, and have everything destroyed.
Richard, to which judge has this case been assigned, and what do you think of him?
Yeah, so I think we got a good judge here. It was assigned to Judge Kotel, K-O-E-T-L. He has been in the Southern District since 1995. I believe he was appointed by Bill Clinton. He is a very, very seasoned bright, learned jurist who has actually had a prior decision involving WikiLeaks where he held that the publisher, WikiLeaks, had a First Amendment right to publish what it was publishing, and who is very, very, very familiar with not only the law, but what went on with WikiLeaks and Assange and the government. So I think we have a really good judge. I'm very happy we have a seasoned judge. It's very helpful to us.
Richard, how do you think your lawsuit will affect the extradition of Assange? Do you think it'll figure in the trial if he's extradited to the United States?
I think it should. I hope it affects the extradition. One of the extradition proceeding, which we know Mr. Assange lost but is up for appeal, one of the elements to that proof that the government had to show was essentially fairness, and clearly this goes right, it just rings right into the middle of that element in the government's burden of proof. And whether it affects the U.S. trial, we don't know. I mean, just think about it. Mr. Assange had his criminal lawyers went to visit him at the embassy, and their computers and laptops and cell phones were imaged. And they actually were able to, which is just mind-boggling, they were actually able to hear the conversations Mr. Assange had with his own lawyer defending the case against the U.S. government. So I don't know what the judge in the Northern District of Virginia is going to do in that case. I unfortunately, he'll probably be extradited. The Northern District of Virginia is a very difficult district, very defense-oriented district. I don't know, but he's subject to, I think it's like 175 years of jail time if he loses. So we don't know what's going to happen. We do think that this is something that has to be considered by both the appellate court and the extradition proceeding and the Northern District of Virginia. But we're not that optimistic, because look what they've gotten away with so far. This poor man's been maximum security in England, which is another outrage. He's a journalist, and he was pent up in the Ecuadorian embassy for years. So it's been like 9 years of his life. He's got a wife. He's got kids. I don't know how much it's going to play in the proceedings. I hope it does, but I mean, hope springs eternal. I may be too optimistic.
Richard, about a year ago, Yahoo News revealed that Donald Trump had asked the CIA to draw up plans to kidnap or assassinate Assange while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy. Do you think that the UC Global surveillance was related to those plans?
I think that there was clearly a desire to bring down Julian Assange any way possible. The fact that there, and this has only been reported, but if in fact there was an attempt to assassinate Mr. Assange, could you imagine that? A U.S. administration trying to assassinate a publisher? Even assuming he's guilty of the Espionage Act, which I don't believe he is, we believe we live in a first world country. Who would know with what happened on January 6th? But it's nothing short of an outrage that if in fact that was planned to kill someone because you don't agree with what they publish, that just doesn't happen in this country. And quite frankly, I think more investigations should have gone on in connection with the Yahoo News report, because that's just unfathomable that an administration would want to literally end the life of a publisher.
What kind of support, Richard, does the other side have? I understand that both the Democratic Party, of course, under Biden, and the intelligence agencies are all for getting their hands on Assange. What's your take on that?
That's another really good question. We don't know what Biden wants to do. It's obvious that Biden is not as aggressive as certainly Trump and Pompeo were. It's on the one hand, we would love to see Biden take control and have the Department of Justice look and see whether that indictment is based on fact or whether it was just beefed up. But it's a hot potato subject matter. So Biden probably is thinking in his inner circles not to touch it and just to let it play out. Because if there are people out there, the followers of the Pompeos and Trumps of the country, which there certainly are, who believe that what he did was what Assange did was he should be tried for. And yet there's a good amount of people who believe that it's crazy what they're doing. So it's sort of a hot potato that Biden doesn't want to touch. We're hopeful that one day he does get involved in it. I'm hopeful that once the evidence comes out and it's revealed that the indictment is not based on facts, and the indictment says that he actually went in and hacked the U.S. computers or assisted in hacking the U.S. computers when he's sitting in the Ecuadorian embassy, he didn't have the password, he didn't have access. So hopefully, if and when that comes out, Biden will get involved, possibly pardon him, possibly have the Department of Justice look at this closer. The good news is that they're not after Assange as much as Pompeo was. But the bad news is he may not want to touch this.
Now, you're saying Biden is not as aggressive as Trump, but the Obama administration, when Biden was part of it, impaneled a secret grand jury, and even though the Obama administration had indicted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all prior presidents combined, they decided not to indict Assange because of what was called the New York Times problem. Because, as you said, WikiLeaks didn't really do anything different than the New York Times and other publications did, publishing this classified information, which is what investigative journalists do all the time. Then Trump comes along, indicts Assange. Then Biden comes along. He could have dismissed the request for extradition. Biden could have dismissed the indictment filed by the Trump administration. But Biden's Department of Justice is still vigorously pursuing this case against Assange. Do you really think there's any chance that Biden is going to drop the request for extradition and dismiss the indictment?
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think there is a chance that he's going to drop the request for extradition. The only chance I think that Assange has is when he is before the Northern District of Virginia, if in fact it comes out that the allegation, the indictment, are just not supported by the evidence. That's the only way I think that the Department of Justice will say, what are we doing here? Unfortunately, this man has been through a very, very difficult time, a difficult road, and you're right. The Trump administration drafted up this indictment, which has allegations in it, which I obviously don't have the evidence, but I can't imagine that WikiLeaks is going to actually conspire with Manning to hack into the NSA. So I don't know if Biden is going to do anything. I just hope that once the evidence comes out and once there's a proceeding in the Northern District of Virginia, then possibly the Department of Justice may say the lawyers in the Department of Justice may turn to Garland and say, what are we doing here? We don't have evidence to indict to convict this guy. The other thing that's very interesting is that just this week, Rand Paul, in support of the Donald Trump subpoena that went into Mar-a-Lago, came out and said the Espionage Act should be repealed. So now you have Republicans saying repeal the act. You have Democrats saying, why is this guy in jail in the first place? So there's a little momentum, but I think you're right. I don't know if Biden's going to do anything. I think it would only happen once we start getting into the nitty-gritty in Virginia. And I think he will be extradited, unfortunately.
What kind of physical and mental shape is Julian Assange in?
My knowledge is not good. My knowledge is that, in fact, that was in the decision by the British court. They said that he was in very bad mental and physical shape. He's in maximum security prison in Belmarsh in London. Think about it. If Manning brought this information to the New York Times, you don't think the New York Times would have published it? And that's what he's been thrown in jail for, and he's going to be extradited and tried. So his condition, as I understand it, is not good at all. He's sitting in prison. He's been sitting in an embassy. He hasn't seen the light of air, except for the fact that he could look out the window in the Ecuadorian embassy since 2000. I think it's 15. He's not doing well at all, and it's such a travesty that this just continues to go. It goes on, and no one's reversing this course.
If Biden and his administration and the CIA and the media that seem to be ignoring the whole situation, if Assange is convicted, what does that mean for investigative journalism?
Well, that's a very scary question, and that's why this case is getting so much attention. It is a real assault on the First Amendment. To have someone who's an investigative journalist worry whether they can publish something, even though they got it legally, which is damaging to the government. That's a very, very scary place that this country would be in. We pride ourselves in the fact that the press should be able to do what Assange did. And the New York Times does it. I can't tell you, a month doesn't go by where I read the front page of the New York Times. I say to myself, my God, look what they got. And it's no different than the information that WikiLeaks has published. So it's a very, very scary precedent to say that a publisher who received information, even if it was illegally received, has an obligation to keep it confidential when all he's trying to do is show transparency. That is what the journalists are most concerned about.
Of course, Richard, the substance of the indictment against Assange alleges that he and WikiLeaks revealed evidence of U.S. war crimes.
We're coming to an end of our allotted time, Richard. Before we have to say goodbye, do you have any final thoughts?
So I appreciate the amount of attention this case is drawing. I think it is something that we really have to sit back and look at and say to ourselves, the government has many tentacles, and to allow the government, particularly the CIA, to actually spy on U.S. citizens without their knowledge, it's outrageous. Our hope is that we can show this to jurors and have them essentially agree and say that this is not, the government has overstepped its bounds.
Well, Attorney Richard Roth, thank you so much for joining us today on Law and Disorder and for your important work in support of the publisher and journalist Julian Assange.
You have every success in this. Good luck, and we look forward to having you back on to talk more about this case. You take it easy.
Anytime. Anytime.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
September 11th will mark the 21st anniversary of the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon by 19 hijackers. They provided a pretext for the U.S.'s 20-year war in Afghanistan and its subsequent invasion of Iraq, an illegal U.S. war of aggression which was based on a lie that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. That war killed more than 1 million people. Today, we rebroadcast a Law and Disorder interview we did with retired Florida Senator, the courageous Bob Graham. Graham did more than anyone to expose the connection between the horrific criminal attacks and the complicity of the Saudi government. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has been a U.S. ally in the Middle East for decades. 21 years ago, Saudi officials gave financial, logistical, and other support to the 9/11 hijackers. 15 of these men were Saudis. This explosive history was documented in 2002 in the 28-page final section of the report of the Joint Commission of Inquiry of the Senate and the House, which Senator Graham chaired. These 28 pages were hidden and not declassified and released until July 15th of 2016. They were released because of the efforts of Senator Graham and the families of the 9/11 victims. By blocking the release of these pages, Senator Graham states the U.S. government sent a message to the Saudi government that, quote, they can do anything, close quote. Graham's prediction was borne out by the 2018 assassination of the journalist and Saudi citizen Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered and dismembered in the Saudi Arabian embassy in Turkey by orders of the Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Nevertheless, last month, President Joe Biden traveled to Saudi Arabia to meet with Mohammed bin Salman and greeted him not with a customary handshake, but with a collegial fist bump. This occurred despite Biden's earlier declaration that, quote, Khashoggi was in fact murdered and dismembered, and I believe at the order of the Crown Prince, close quote. Oil and arms sales are the reasons why the United States continues to embrace Saudi Arabia as a close ally. Saudi Arabia has the second largest supply of reserve oil in the world. The U.S. needs it now because of Russia's war in the Ukraine. According to the U.S. State Department, in a statement of May 11th of 2022, quote, Saudi Arabia is the United States' largest foreign military sales, FMS, customer with more than $100 billion in FMS cases. Law and Disorder co-hosts Heidi Bogosian and Michael Smith interviewed Senator Bob Graham before the missing 28 pages of the 9/11 report were finally released. These pages confirmed Senator Graham's belief that the hijackers could not have pulled off the operation alone. It reveals that the hijackers were part of a support network involving the Saudi monarchy and government, which helped plan, pay for, and execute the complicated 9/11 plot. Senator Graham has written the book Intelligent Matters, the CIA, the FBI, Saudi Arabia, and the Failure of America's War on Terror. It provides a candid insight into U.S. and Saudi relations. Senator Bob Graham is the former two-term governor of Florida and served for 18 years in the U.S. Senate, in addition to 12 years in the Florida legislature, for a total of 38 years of public service.
Retired U.S. Senator Bob Graham from Florida is the former head of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee. He's also the leading person trying to get President Obama to release to the public the suppressed 28 pages of the 9/11 report, which until now had been hidden. Senator Graham contends that the 19 hijackers, 15 of whom were Saudi Arabians, could not have pulled off the operation alone, and that in fact they were part of a support network involving the Saudi Arabian monarchy and government, which helped plan, pay for, and execute the complicated 9/11 plot. Senator Graham said otherwise it would have been impossible for them to accomplish this. Senator Graham has written the book called Intelligence Matters, the CIA, FBI, Saudi Arabia, and the Failure of America's War on Terror. It provides a candid insight to the workings of the U.S. in Saudi relations and their implications on U.S. foreign policy making as it pertains to the Middle East. Senator Graham, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
We'd like to start by just asking a bit about your background, where you grew up, what the influence of your father was, and what positions you hold in the U.S. Senate.
I grew up on a dairy farm about 25 miles northwest of Miami. I was very influenced by my surroundings, which were the Everglades, a passion of mine. I was very much influenced by my parents. My father was a very wise man. He was also a very high integrity person and had run and been elected to the Florida State Senate in order to be a factor in cleaning out some of the corruption which had afflicted South Florida during the post-World War or pre-World War II period. That was a significant influence on my subsequent decision to pursue a career in elective office, and I frequently used the examples and lessons that I had learned from my parents in various political decisions that I had
Senator, you served on the 9/11 Commission when you were still in the Senate, and you've said in the past that you became disillusioned, and I wanted to ask you, why was that?
Well, I did not serve on the 9/11 Commission, which was a citizens' commission. I co-chaired, as chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the joint inquiry of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees into 9/11, with particular focus on the role of the U.S. intelligence agencies. After we finished our inquiry, which was in December of 2002, the Citizens Commission accepted our voluminous materials that we had developed and an over 800-page report, and they commenced their investigation, which went beyond the Intelligence Committee to a number of other agencies, such as the role of the Federal Aviation Authority.
Senator, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi Arabians. Do you believe they could plan, pay for, and execute the complex plot of 9/11 involving hijacking of airplanes without external support?
Absolutely not. These 19 people, most of them did not speak English. Most of them had never been to the United States before. Most of them were not particularly well educated. That they could carry out a plot of this sophistication over a time period, which for some of them was 18 months, and avoid detection is implausible. That's the word that the chairs of the 9/11 Commission have used to describe this matter. It is implausible to me that the United States government, 15 years later, still clings to the position that these 19 people did, in fact, operate alone without any external support, and therefore their inquiries have, in my opinion, been very unnecessarily truncated, because they haven't gone into the question of who were the groups that supported the 9/11 hijackers, because they don't believe they exist. The U.S. government does not believe that an external support network exists.
And specifically, who do you believe that external support network consists of?
Primarily Saudis. As you stated, 15 of the 19 hijackers were themselves Saudi nationals with government involvement, were the primary funders of al-Qaeda and continue to be a primary funder, as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said during her tenure, that the primary source of funding of terrorism was Saudi Arabia. And I also, Saudi Arabia has been the principal promoter of this extreme form of Islam called Wahhabism, where young people are taught intolerance, jihad, and encouraged to act out against non-believers, and therefore have provided a steady stream of fresh recruits to terrorist organizations, from al-Qaeda to now ISIS.
Senator, why do you think that the United States government ignored the warnings that something terrible was going to happen prior to 9/11? And then my next question is going to be, why haven't they been more forthright in discussing who might have done it afterwards? But let's talk about before 9/11. Isn't it true that the president gets a daily briefing, and mightn't he have been warned about this?
Yes, and he was. The 9/11 Commission developed the concept. It was a lack of imagination that we knew significant amount about al-Qaeda and about what its intentions were. They had tried to hijack airplanes in the Philippines several years before 9/11. They had been the primary operatives in the attacks on two U.S. embassies in Africa, so they were not an unknown adversary. But with all of that, we didn't have the imagination that they might be plotting to attack not thousands of miles away on another continent, but attack in the United States and technology, commercial airliners, that they had tried to use in the Philippines.
After the attack, there's 28 pages of the report that haven't been released. And I know that you're under constraints and can't talk about what's in those pages, but I know you've written a book called Keys to the Kingdom, which is a novel about that. And I wondered whether you might talk about the novel so we could try to understand what's been suppressed.
First, about the 28 pages, the final report that was submitted in December of 2002 was over 800 pages. One chapter of 28 pages was totally redacted, and that chapter has been publicly acknowledged as primarily dealing with who financed 9/11 and pointed a very strong finger at Saudi Arabia, not surprisingly. I wrote a book called Intelligence Matters, which is a nonfiction book about the before 9/11, during, and then the investigation afterwards. There was a significant amount of that book which was censured. I was frustrated by that, and while I was a senior fellow at the Kennedy School, one of the faculty members suggested that I could tell the stories that were excluded from the nonfiction Intelligence Matters by writing it as a novel. So that was the origin of Keys the Kingdom. I say Intelligence Matters asks the questions, and Keys the Kingdom gives the answers.
Senator, tell us a bit about the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandor. Why did he get President Bush to allow over 100 persons to fly out of the U.S. right after 9/11 before they could be questioned?
He had a very personal relationship with the Bush administration and with President Bush himself. The Bush family has been close to the House of Saud going back to the grandfather, Prescott Bush. So when the ambassador called the White House in the hours immediately after 9/11 saying that he wanted to meet with the president, he was accommodated. They met in the White House. Prince Bandar said that there were many elite Saudis in the United States. It happened that at that time in Kentucky, the horse sales were going on, and that had brought together not only Saudis who lived in the United States, but Saudis from around the world, and that he, Prince Bandar, was concerned that they were going to be harassed and asked the president for permission, even though most of American aviation was grounded at the time, if he could get a chartered plane to fly these Saudi elites back to their home in Saudi Arabia. The president agreed with that, and a few days later, after collecting Saudis elsewhere, chartered plane flew from Lexington, Kentucky to Saudi Arabia with approximately 145 elite Saudis, including members of Osama bin Laden's family, back to Riyadh.
Whoa. Let's talk about Osama bin Laden, if we might, Senator. Bin Laden was, of course, from one of the elite families in Saudi Arabia, and there's been speculation that he told the government that he was willing to cause civil unrest in that country, that he was unhappy about certain policies that the government was carrying out, particularly with respect to the United States. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, the background of that goes to the first Persian Gulf War, the one that was in 1990-91 when Iraq had invaded Kuwait. Bin Laden had just come off being a major factor in defeating the Russians in Afghanistan and had some 30,000 war-hardened veterans at his call. He went to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and said, I can protect the kingdom from Saddam Hussein. You don't need to call on the Europeans or the Americans. The king at that time rejected bin Laden's offer and, in fact, did invite the United States and the Europeans who, in the early period of 1991, routed the Iraqis from Kuwait. Bin Laden never forgot that slight. At some point later in the 1990s, when he had returned to Afghanistan and was beginning the planning for what became 9/11, he became aware that this was going to be a very complicated process. I mean, compare what happened in 9/11 to what happened in Paris recently. The complexity of hijacking multiple airlines at the same time, having people who were technically capable then of flying the airplanes, being able to identify the targets and hit them in a very compressed period of time, were daunting challenges. Bin Laden figured out that these 19 people, with their linguistic and cultural limitations, were unlikely to be able to do that. And so he went to the kingdom and said, we want your support. I'm not saying that he specifically told the Saudi royal family what his ultimate plan was, but that he was going to have representatives of Al-Qaeda in the United States, and they needed to have people who could assist them, provide financing, give them access to some of the services that they would need, such as flight training, and protect their anonymity, and that if the kingdom didn't do all of the above, he would unleash his 30,000 warriors and start a civil war in Saudi Arabia. The kingdom capitulated and made available to the Bin Laden a network primarily based on people who had been representing Saudi Arabia surreptitiously in the United States to oversee young Saudis, college age principally, who the kingdom were concerned might be plotting against the kingdom in the same way that college students had overthrown the Shah of Iran. A complicated story, but Bin Laden played the piano of all of these different people, histories, values, concerns very well, and the kingdom made available to him what he'd requested, and I don't think 9/11 would have happened but for that.
Is that the reason you think that this has all been covered up?
Why it's been covered up by the United States government is another mystery. It's easier to answer the question for the Bush administration. I mentioned earlier the close personal relationship that the Bush family had with the House of Saud. Oil was another consideration. When President Obama ran in 2008, he ran on a platform of opposition to the war in Iraq. There was a lot of expectation that he would reverse these policies of non-disclosure of information about 9/11 when he became president. And in fact, and I can't say this firsthand, but it's been reported that President Obama told some of the families of the victims of 9/11 that he would release these documents. And now, in his eighth year as president, it hasn't happened. I'm an optimist. I still hold out hope that before January 20th, 2017, that President Obama will deliver on that promise that he has allegedly made and make all this information available to let the American people know what's the nature of our relationship with Saudi Arabia and be part of the decision-making process as to what should we do about it.
Senator, what are you doing now to secure the release of the suppressed 28 pages?
Well, there are a number of things which I hope are going to contribute to President Obama deciding to release these. One of those is this considerable amount of media interest, which had been dormant up until about a year ago. Now there are regular stories and reports, much in line with what we're talking about today. Also in the Congress, there is a resolution to ask the president to release specifically the 28 pages on who financed 9/11. I think there's growing pressure for a release, and I hope it'll reach critical mass in the next 12 months.
The government of Saudi Arabia has been sued on behalf of wrongful death suits on behalf of the family of people who were murdered in the towers. They put up a defense of sovereign immunity. Can you talk about that?
Yes. First, it's very interesting that they have used the defense of sovereign immunity not just to protect the kingdom, but to protect a whole series of charities, foundations, religious institutions, all of which have been alleged to have been involved in some phase of supporting the 9/11 hijackers, primarily financing. Then the Saudi government says, although we use sovereign immunity to protect all these groups from litigation in a U.S. court, we, the kingdom, were not involved in any of these things, and therefore you can't sue us, right? You can't have it both ways. You can't say sovereign immunity applies to non-governmental groups and then say, but the government itself, which is using that defense, is immune. The status is that under the current law that governs suits against terrorist groups by U.S. citizens in U.S. courts, it's almost necessary to make your case beyond reasonable doubt before you can even get a hearing. And what has happened is that on several occasions, the families of 9/11 victims have been dismissed from court. And I'm sad to report the U.S. government has supported those dismissals. Now the Second District in New York City has reversed at least one of those dismissals, and the case has been refiled, and it's working its way back through the system. And in Congress, there's an effort underway to change the law so that it's not so onerous, and plaintiffs representing persons who have been killed or otherwise adversely affected by terrorists can get their day in court. I hope that this Congress will pass that. It almost passed at the last Congress, and I am optimistic again that that the Congress that's seated today will make adjustments to the law so that it will be more rational for American citizens to find justice.
Senator Bob Graham, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you if you have any final thoughts on this before we have to say goodbye.
Yes, maybe the most persuasive argument to Americans to keep all these materials disclosed is national security, that in some way it would have an adverse effect on our safety if this information were made public. I think it is absolutely the opposite, that the fact is that we have sent a message to Saudi Arabia that they can do anything with impunity, with absolute assurance that they will not be sanctioned, and that fact of the message of impunity through the unwillingness to disclose information in the possession of the United States government about Saudi Arabia's action at 9/11 has encouraged Saudi Arabia to continue to support terrorist groups, now ISIS, and to continue madrasas and mosques, which shape the young minds of Muslims so that they are prepared and religiously motivated to want to fill the ranks of ISIS or other terrorist organizations. So to me, our national security is being dramatically adversely affected by the way in which we have related to Saudi Arabia for its support for the 9/11 hijackers. I think it's an outrage, and I hope that the Obama administration will not leave this as their legacy.
Senator Bob Graham, it's really been an honor for us to have a person with your intelligence and courage on Law and Disorder, and we thank you so much for being our guest.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your carrying this message to the people of America.
Thank you, Senator.
Best of luck.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.